RadioInfluence.com. This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to the Landry Football Podcast for this Thursday, February 6th, as we put the football season, the playing season, to bed. Hope you enjoyed the Super Bowl. No, we're a few days away from it now, but certainly want to react to a few things with it. And as I said last week, talk about kind of what happens now for those teams. We kind of brought you into how to prepare for a Super Bowl. What's that like? As well as, you know, what happens during the course of the game. And I figured, as I said last week, we'll get to what kind of happens now after the season is a little bit later. And again, the off season and the work and the preparation, which football is a 12-month-a-year profession, how does that really work? And what challenges, good challenges, but what challenges does it present for the team that are in the Super Bowl? So hope, again, you enjoyed the game, everything associated with it. You know, my thoughts, and I have discussed it on LandryFootball.com. And a reminder that you can get detailed film room breakdowns on all things football, the games, free agency, the draft, recruiting in college. We've got it all for you in our scouting season sale. Is the best we've ever had, so take advantage of it. But I talked a lot about going into the game, the advantages that both had, but how completely different both teams were. You have a San Francisco team that's really good at the line of scrimmage, that runs the football well, rushes the passer well, had some distinct advantages, and certainly for Kansas City, a speed advantage, no doubt, and playmaking ability. And as the game unfolded, there was a lot of good and some not so good by both sides. For San Francisco, I thought they controlled the game in the first half at the line of scrimmage, was able to run the football well. A lot of criticism going towards Kyle Shanahan for not being aggressive enough and using more timeouts to try to score at the end of the first half. But as I've explained, you got to understand the strengths and weaknesses of both of the teams. And understanding is the key to be able to figure out what's the best way to attack. What's the best way to deal with this ourselves. And if you are a team that is a play-action passing team, that you need some time to kind of work the game, stay on schedule. This Niner team did a pretty good job against the Saints and a couple of other times during the year in the two-minute offense, but that's not their strength. Wanting to maintain control of the game, knowing that they're got a 10-10 tie and getting the ball to start out in the second half, the unwillingness to be so aggressive as to potentially get a three and out and put an explosive Kansas City team on the field with a chance to take the lead, I thought was risky. Oh, it's well, but you got to risk it. You got to do this. It's a Super Bowl. Your job is to do the best job you can to give your team the best team to win, best chance to win. And I thought he did that. As they were able to make one big play to Kittle, it was called back due to the interference, but they had a chance still to make some points. But it was positioned to where they were either going to make points or they were going to go in at halftime. It's kind of like, you know what? We're going to get the last shot in the basketball game, and we're not going to give the other team another shot at it. That's kind of the way they played it. I got no problem with it. And again, you know, people will look, well, that's not what they do, and that's not what's their strength. So understand that. I think that's really important. A couple of things that items I'll get to a little bit later, but some big picture items as it relates to the fourth quarter. Because I thought that the Niners not only outplayed Kansas City for the first half, but for the third quarter. The fourth quarter was the one in which obviously Kansas City made some significant changes on how they approached it with a lot of success. I thought the key to the game was Kansas City's defense and their ability to create some pressure, made some significant adjustments, getting the linebackers closer to the line of scrimmage, aggressively using run blitzes to force the Niners out of the run game. Basically, risking and giving up the passing game and trying to take away the run, because the one thing that Kansas City did in the fourth quarter that they did not do in the first three quarters was lose their patience. Mainly, San Francisco had controlled the clock for the most part, controlled the possessions. Kansas City had long possessions themselves. So time of possession is not the whole factor. But the fact that they limited Kansas City to not making the big plays, forcing them to work underneath, take the checkdowns. Those are the things that I think were significant. And Kansas City didn't force the football, except for a couple of occasions. We saw a couple of picks. You saw Mahomes get a little frustrated. But what happened in the fourth quarter was Kansas City, out of desperation, had to do two things. One, be aggressive on offense. Two, be aggressive on defense. But more so on defense, because they could not afford San Francisco with a lead to just grind out the clock. So they forced the Niners to the air. People will say, and you heard this certainly on the hot take circuit, that, well, they got away from their identity. They got away from running the football as much because of how Kansas City overplayed the run. And at some point, and I think most of the season they proved they did it pretty well, some point you've got to make plays in the passing game. And they weren't able to do that. They weren't able to block effectively against A-gap pressure. Got ball tipped. Folks, breaking down the tape, that George Kittle was open. There was some play calls that were pretty doggone good. They didn't execute them. Now, that's still on you as a coach as well. I'm not saying that, oh, poor Kyle Shanahan, he's getting criticized. So what? I mean, you're a head coach, you make a lot of money, you're going to get criticized. Comes with the territory. What I'm trying to do is explain that when you're looking at the film with a trained eye, you're seeing it a lot differently than the fans. You get, well, why do they run the football here or there? People, you hear me talk about play calling all the time. Play calling is not done in a vacuum. Okay, it's directly correlated, yes, to down distance, position on the field, time left in the game, get all that. But it's also due with how the defense is playing you. And if they're going to take something away, you've got to be able to make them pay. And the Niners had the play calls to make them pay. They didn't execute it. I thought Kansas City did a pretty good job taking away the first read for the most of the game. But in the latter stages, when they became hyper-aggressive against the run, they didn't have Kittle covered. But they got enough pressure in Garoppolo's face, and the Niners didn't protect it well enough, and Garoppolo didn't get the ball out in time or accurately, or in a couple of cases, completely misread it. Had him wide open on the third down play that just goes completely sails incomplete. Kittle is wide open for what would have possibly been a touchdown, definitely a first down. So, no, it wasn't play calls that killed him. It's play execution, which is falls under coaching and was a big factor in the course of the game. So I credit for Kansas City for taking that away, that forcing the issue, not laying back. And then, of course, the biggest play of the game was the third and 15 that Mahomes completed to Tyreek Hill. And that was a misplay in coverage. The biggest one in which the deep third safety is up and doesn't sink deep enough, quick enough. He bites on the crosser, which that's a eye discipline violation there. And that's exactly where Hill caught the ball, is exactly where he needed to be, sinked in to defend it. made a play. That doesn't happen. Who knows what happens? Give credit for the Chiefs for aggressively taking some things and forcing San Francisco into a lack of comfort zone and then aggressively making some plays. Mahomes on that throw that I refer to is throwing it off his back foot. There's just enough to get it there. And then, of course, that led to the Kelce interference call in the end zone on Kelce and set up the touchdown to cut it to 2017. And then, obviously, there's another coverage violation on the pass completion to Watkins. And then, eventually, the Chiefs go in with the go-ahead score, which was the winning score they tacked on later. But I think it's important to understand that in a game like this, yes, you stick with what you do well, but you have to be able to execute an alternative way to beat an opponent if they're going to overplay you and take away what you do well. You have to be able to do that. And if you can't, you're not going to win at the highest level. Oh, yes, you may be able to impose your will in week 6 or week 12 of the regular season against a certain opponent. You're not going to be able to do it at this highest level. Because you've got to be able to make enough plays. You've got to be able to score enough points to put an opponent like Kansas City away. San Francisco's defense played a good enough game overall to have a really good chance to win this, but they couldn't score enough points on offense. Give credit to Kansas City for making some adjustments that worked, and San Francisco made the adjustments that they couldn't execute on the adjustments they made. So I just say this to try to further inform that when people, because people, when they talk about this, every talking head, it's about, you know, just repeating what the next guy said. They don't know. I mean, they don't know. They're just repeating it. They're not looking at film. They don't really know what they're looking at when they're looking at film. And so understand that the criticism is always fair, but understand exactly what they criticize. To say, you know, well, they did this or that. The first key in the film room, the first key in a football operations area is to determine specifically what went wrong. Because if you don't accurately determine what went wrong, then how can you fix it? And this is kind of like if your car stalls on the highway and you're changing one part, that's not the problem. You didn't fix the problem. You've got to diagnose what the problem is. And today they put it under computers and can diagnose all that. Did it a different way back in the day. And I have no idea how to do either one. But you've got to diagnose the problem and correct it so that if it's this part or that part, then you replace it. Doesn't do any good to replace the tires if the tires are not the problem. And so I'm not saying that when you look at this that you say all it was great, but you look at the execution and it was flawed. The protection pickup was flawed, and certainly the quarterback recognition was flawed. All things that are not to point a finger at this is a problem, I think all are correctable going forward. But they're only correctable if you identify them correctly first. And that's what I'm trying to do and explain. So again, it is not meant to say, I don't criticize the coaching, don't criticize the play calling ever. No. I'm not saying that at all. But understand that play calls don't come in necessarily with the idea that we're going to call the play. The play that is run that you criticize may not have been the play call. It was one of the play options, and the quarterback may have made the wrong read in the decision pre-snap. Or in the case of a read on a pass play, made the wrong decision post-snap on his post-snap read. Now, it all still falls on the coaching, because if you're having trouble with pre and post snap reads, then you've got to get that corrected. So that is just as fair criticism as any. But just, you know, from a fundamental understanding, don't fall into the trap that every other hot take talking head says that bad play call this or that. Ask them what was the front, what was the coverage on the play call, and it couldn't tell you. Well, if you don't know that, then you can't know what's the right play call or not. So there's play call, there's play execution. It all falls under a realm of criticism that is justifiable, but just understand it specifically. So as we try to do here, try to bring out some of those things that I think are really, really relevant. was asked about the delay of game non-call. I got a question that was sent in. That if you remember on the last play that the Niners had with the ball, Garoppolo was hit, but there was a clock went to zero. So you understand the delay of game rule. And if you're watching it on TV, of course, they have the play clock. You see it go to zero, you're automatically thinking what? Delay of game, penalty. It's not the case. Here's what happens. When the clock goes zero, the official that's looking at the clock then turns to the snap. And if the snap is in the process of being executed, it's legal. And here's why. Most of you can relate to this if you watch basketball. You notice that basketball clocks now have, it's not, you know, 10, not 5 seconds left, it's 5.2. When a clock goes from 1 second to zero, it doesn't go from 1 second to zero. As you know, it goes to 1 second to 0.9, 0.8, 0.7, obviously in lightning fast speed, understand. So when it goes to zero, it is taught from an official standpoint to look at the clock when it's zero, turn. If it's being in the process of being snapped, it's fine because it's deemed to be in that 0.9 to 0.1 area before it goes to zero. Okay? You know, it's been a lot of discussion. Could you maybe have, like, you have a big horn sound in basketball? You could do that. That's not how it's done in football. And there is that lapse time. It's not a lapse time. It's a lapse time, if you will, from 1 second to 0.9, 0.8, 0.7 to 0.1. So, you know, is it possible? It could have been, perhaps, but that was officiated exactly like it was supposed to be. And it's not under review, but it was also not a reviewable call, but it's also not an incorrect call. And I think a lot of people just assume, hey, it went to zero and they hadn't snapped it. Well, it's went to zero, but you have to account for going to zero, take a look at, and that's a split second. And listen, it's a hair. I mean, is it 0.5, 0.6, 0.7, 0.2 seconds to make that turn determination? That's all part of the lag that's allowed. Now, if you got the clock to zero and you turn and it's still not snapped, it's not in the process, then you blow the whistle, throw the flag. So you can look at it and make your own judgment that maybe they were slow on it, slower. That's all part of the lag time and all part of it. So it wasn't anything done that should have been reviewed. And, of course, it was important because if it was a dead play, then the Niners, that play at the end, would not have counted and would have had another shot at it. So it's important, but it wasn't incorrectly officiated. In fact, it was correctly officiated the way it's supposed to. So good question. Thanks for bringing that up. Another question we got here. Richard asks, in terms of play callers on offense, which offensive coordinator is the best currently in the NFL? Well, the best play caller in the league is Sean Payton, who's the head coach of the Saints, the play caller. He's the best play caller. Andy Reid in Eric Bieniemy. Eric Bieniemy calls the plays. Andy Reid has been one of the better ones. I think Eric is one of the best. You know, and again, good play callers, it's all relative to your offense and what you have. And good play calls are really the byproduct of calling good plays to fit what you do. Greg Roman is one of the best play callers. It calls completely different different concepts and ideas because you've got Lamar Jackson as opposed to what Eric Bieniemy has with Patrick Mahomes or what Sean Payton has with Drew Brees. There are a number of them. Doug Peterson is a really good play caller. Wasn't very good with all those weapons out this past year, but you saw what he was able to do down the stretch in the Eagles Super Bowl run. Sean McVay is a good play caller. So there are a number of guys that are good play callers. What is your assessment of Josh McDaniels as a play caller? Josh is another one. Better play caller when you got weapons around Tom Brady, and it works a lot better. He's one of the best play callers around. No question, Josh is. Richard also says, what was your scouting evaluation of Steve Atwater? Steve Atwater was an in-the-box safety that played like a linebacker in an era where he was an enforcer. He was an enforcer over the middle. He was a big time run defender that played in against run-oriented systems. So he came down from the deep end, and he punished people. He was one of the biggest hitters from the safety position you'd have. So he's one of the all-time greats. Would probably have to play linebacker in today's game, which this is more of a coverage game than a run defending game. And you ask, what about John Lynch out of Stanford? John was a bright player. He's a pretty good tackler, physical in his own right. Not great in coverage, but a little bit more rangy than, say, a guy like, Atwater. Who had the better career of the two? Gosh, I mean, Atwater was more of an enforcer. Atwater had more of an impact to the Broncos defense in that era. It was, again, a run defense-focused era, and he was a big feature point that you had to game plan against. John Lynch was a great player, but was a really good role-playing hitter, deep defender in the cover two scheme, a Tampa two scheme that they ran, but wasn't the most important factor. I mean, it's up front with Warren Sapp and the two edge guys, so they had four-man pressures, and obviously they had Derek Brooks, and then obviously, the Mike backer that could get the deep middle so that he didn't have to – he could come and tackle very well. He wasn't the enforcer Atwater was, nor was he a great rangy safety, but he had better cover skills than Atwater did. But we're talking about players that played in two different eras. So they're very good at what they did. And so hopefully that answers your question. All right, and I want to get into what happens now with these teams, with the Niners and the Chiefs. You've got the celebratory parades and visits, all that. That's great. But as an organization, when you get back, you have to do the same thing that every other team does after their season is over. So you get back to the facility. The team will have exit physicals for all the players. Basically, they give a physical at every player. And so if there are things that need to be cleaned up, we know if a guy's got an injury, is it something that needs to be just healed with time and what's the treatment and how we're going to get it done and how can we expedite it? It may mean the need to have a certain type of medical procedure. All those things are scheduled and are scheduled here probably within the next week or two so that it gives maximum healing time so that you've got maximum time to get ready for OTAs and certainly training camp if it's a more severe injury. So that's what happens from that standpoint. From a coaching standpoint, coaches will break down the tape. Now, I will tell you that when you lose the Super Bowl, sometimes it's very difficult to look at that tape. But your job at the end of the season is to grade every – during the course of the week, grade every game. You've got to write a report on every player at your position that you coach. And on defense, you've got to put a grade on all the players on the defense, all the players on the offense. You have to complete that. Obviously, teams that have been eliminated from the playoffs, it's been done for weeks now. If you're Kansas City and San Francisco, you're just getting started on doing that. So the first step to getting ready for free agency is to evaluate your team, to evaluate your roster. You have to get that in the books, and then you have to get on looking at pro personnel tape to evaluate potential free agents, and then you have to get on the evaluation process of draft prospects. All things, and again, Senior Bowl, East-West game, where some coaches that are eliminated will go to those, your coaches haven't. Your scouting staff has them. So you've got all the verifiable information. You've got all the evaluations done on free agents, but you want independent evaluation from your coaches. So the process is, A, evaluate the team correctly, your current team. And your pro personnel department can expedite, and you have meetings after you evaluate. So you coming out of the meetings, you evaluate your team. All right, not only have you evaluated the tape, but now we take into account contract status. You might love a player. You might want him back. He may be too costly. And if you got three key guys coming up, you may only be able to afford to get two. Which two are you going to sign? Which is going to be your priority? So you combine the film evaluation with the salary cap strategy. You look at the injury situation. You put all that together. And you begin to make decisions on what's our priority this offseason. And then based on that, you're going to focus free agency and get your position coaches and your coordinators involved in looking at guys who potentially could be free agents. You expedite it by having your pro personnel department have a pretty good feel who's likely going to enter free agency as opposed to who's not. You don't spend time looking at Drew Brees if you're a position coach, if you're a quarterback coach, because he's not going to be available for free agency. Now, your pro personnel department looks at every player and grades them during the course of the year. That's their job. But you want to make sure that you give them a streamlined number of players to look at that you pretty sure are going to hit free agency, and then have those players be evaluated and compared up against the players that you have on your team. So perhaps it's a player that you like on your team, but there's not much difference financially between the player on your team and a player that's going to be a free agent. Well, if all else is equal, if the financial distribution of the player's cap outlay is going to be similar, and the other factors like injuries and age are in line, well, then you're going to go with the guy that you have on your roster. You're more familiar with them. It makes sense. But what if you've got the same type of guy, but the other guy on the other team is a little bit younger and may not cost quite as much, but can do the same thing? You can begin to make some of those decisions. And so that's the order of what you do. And then you get into evaluating players at your position in the college draft process before you go to the combine. So that when you go to the combine and you interview these players as a position coach or running back coach, for example, you have looked at these guys on tape. You have a good feel for them. You've got a little bit of a feel for their background, so that they know better how to interview them and maybe get some information. You could also encourage coaches to pick up the phone and call anybody that they know on the staffs, college staffs of these players, and say, you know, tell me about so-and-so. Type of learner is he? Is he a rep guy? Whatever. So that you get a feel. So you have all that intel going into your interview with the player so that you can kind of discern in a short time frame what's this guy's capability of learning, picking things up. All those things are very, very integral. And you obviously work through that. That's the job of those staffs. Now, the scouting staff doesn't really change because the college scouting department, regardless of whether you're eliminated and don't even make the playoffs or you win the Super Bowl, make the Super Bowl, you're still going to all the All-Star games. You're looking at all the film. You're not doing things any differently. You may spend a few days at the Super Bowl site. Outside of that, you've done everything the same as you would do if your team didn't win. Now, the pro personnel side is the same thing. They're looking at every player on every team, broken up sometimes by conference, different pro personnel scouts. They'll scout throughout the entire season and look at their players, look at the players around the league. Well, you will have usually one or two people that's responsible for advanced scouting, which means scouting the upcoming opponent, the next upcoming opponent. Well, that person obviously is busy preparing in the playoffs for your next upcoming opponent. So those analysts slash pro personnel people now can come off that, but mostly you want them to work now on what we call film room analytics of the entire season. So you start working on projects like, all right, we're going to take the entire season of the breakdowns, try to look at our tendencies as if we were scouting us. What did we do? How could we make it better? And then provide that intel to the coaching staff. So the coaching staffs, in addition to breaking down tapes and helping in the evaluation process for free agency and the draft, you're also responsible for working towards improving your ability to make your offense and defense better. And so your analyst type people, pro personnel type people, not the pro personnel scouts evaluating players around the league, but your advanced scout type guys, those are the ones that will, I always wanted the advanced scout guys to spend time breaking down every, start with everybody in our division and break down tendencies of what they're doing. And then the next thing would be to work your way through the league. And not only how can we better attack a certain team, but what are they doing that would be congruent to implement into our system? And so those people get started after the end of the season. The end of the season is just a little bit later now as you go to the Super Bowl. But that's what you want to do, obviously. You want to have less time in the offseason because your goal of everyone is to get into win to the Super Bowl. Both teams, the winner and loser in the Super Bowl, in the same plight because one wins, one loses, but they still have had the same amount of time to implement the offseason program in. You got no advantage if you lose the game. So you get there, you might as well win it. And here's the other thing that you do in the modern day age. Analytics have become big. Analytics are very useful if utilized correctly. You know, here's the thing about analytics. Statistics are accusations. Analytics are the indictment. The tape is the conviction. Okay, so you need to have a good football person to put the data information into perspective. Because when it really comes down to it, knowing that you're ineffective in the red zone is pretty obvious. What's important is why you're not as effective as you could be. That requires film breakdown. So the analytics have always been there. But the analytics that are most important are the ones that are head up by football people. When you break down film and you break down with a defined level of specificity of why you're successful, why you're not successful in certain situations, you can determine that by formation, field position, what you're doing it against. And when you put all the correct data in, you got really good information coming out. But the old analytics, well, they're, you know, 13% effective running this play. Well, that doesn't tell you anything because running that play has to be broken down against every different front, every different coverage to make it legitimate. And you have to look at it against certain opponents. You can look at it as it wasn't a really good play, but we executed because we were physically superior to who we had to block and who we had to get open against, for example. So what you look at from an analytical standpoint is the film breakdown takes you to the data, and the data will then be useful. But as they say, garbage in, garbage out, quality in, quality out. So analytics, I think, are really important, but they're only important if you have a good football person to put the data information into perspective. All right, that'll wrap it up for today. Hey, next week we'll into the offseason. We're going to begin to talk a little bit about preparing for the combine and more about what we're doing in the offseason and preparing for free agency, some of the free agency do's and don'ts. We got all the do's and don'ts, more information about the combine and what you try to get done in preparation for that. So we got a lot of good things to get to as we kind of get into that mold of what you do in the off season, what you do to prepare this time of year for things in the NFL and in college football. College football, we didn't have much of a chance to get into it, but signing day was yesterday. And the importance of recruiting, the importance of being able to factor transfer portal information and possibilities into the mix, all of that's really critical. We're going to get into more and more of that and kind of take you through step by step what the college program, what NFL teams do this time of year. Reminder, if you got a question, go to LandryFootball.com, hit contact Chris, and I will address it right here. Check out LandryFootball.com for all the latest detailed film room analysis. Yes, film room is analysis is going all year round. The games are done, but that's good in this sense that more film can be consumed from the fall. As I like to say, consuming film in the fall is like running on a treadmill. I mean, you're moving, but you're not going anywhere. You're just getting through enough, as much film as possible. Now it's like running in your subdivision where you can kind of gain ground and look at more and more film, and you can create more clarity in the evaluations of players, teams, coaches, and schemes. And that's what we do for you at LandryFootball.com. So take advantage of the big discount that we have that will take you through the entire offseason and the entire football season through the Super Bowl next year. We appreciate you joining us, everybody. Talk to you next week on another edition of Landry, the Landry Football Podcast, part of the Radio Influence Network.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at Landry Football. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence.
Radio Influence strives to bring you excellence in podcasting. We work with personalities like TV chef Brian Duffy, radio personalities like Ian Beckles, news and political pundits like independent journalists Frank and Tracy Beans, experts from the sports world like veteran football scout and coach Chris Landry, pro wrestling personality David Penzer, MMA experts Jason Floyd and Daniel Galvan, and strength and conditioning coach Jeff Crochelle. If you're looking for food, sports, music, entertainment, politics, no matter the topic, Radio Influence has something for everyone. All of Radio Influence's programming can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Podcasts, and RadioInfluence.com.